Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, we're recasting Nate's 2019 interview with Little Willie John biographer Susan Whitehall. From superstardom at age 15 to dead in prison before his 33rd birthday, Little Willie lived a rock and roll nightmare. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm joined by Susan Whitehall, author of Fever, Little Willie John, A Fast Life, Mysterious Death, and the Birth of Soul. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
It's our pleasure. And so tell us a little bit about Little Willie John. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Beatles covered one of his songs on an unreleased track. What else should people know about him in the quick summary?
Well, I think the fact that people don't know who he is, the people who do know who he is are some of the best loved and known musicians of our time. You know, the Bob Dylans, the Beatles, the Elvis Presley was a big fan of his. So I think that alone should tell you something and maybe make people delve into his work more than they have. And he was at a key spot, I think, in the history of rhythm and blues and rock. He was sort of a bridge between the early days and the later soul days, because he really could sing it all. He sang with Count Basie when he was a kid in Detroit. He sang, you know, he could do jazz. My Love Is still it still stands up as a great little jazz recording almost. And he could do soul, he could do R&B. And at the time in the 50s, they called him a rock singer, which was perfect because it encompasses everything.
And he came to a tragic end at an early age.
Yeah, and he accomplished quite a lot because the bulk of his recording was really done in 10 years. When you think about that, that's incredible. But to have created something like the song Fever, which Peggy Lee's version is so dependent upon his, it never would have existed, of course, without him. And according to today's songwriting standards, he should have gotten a co-writing credit on Fever because he added so much to it. At the time, though, you were out of luck if you were a young kid singer, a teenager, and it didn't matter how much you brought to it, how much you changed it. For him to have created that and the other songs that he did, he was the co-writer of Leave My Kitten Alone, which, of course, is one of the best-loved Beatles songs, Beatles recordings, even though it was bootlegged for years. He's just an incredible underground source that it really is such a rewarding thing to look into his music, to play it. People have probably heard his songs without knowing it. That happened to me. As a kid, I heard Sleep on the radio in Philadelphia when I was about probably 8 or something. So, and I heard it later on, like, ah, that's Little Willie John. Oh, my God. So,
and his singing is incredible. I mean, in your book, you quote people who compare him, you know, to Aretha Franklin and Aretha Franklin only, that this is a guy who routinely cut Jackie Wilson, Sam Cooke, James Brown, blew him off stage, and could sing circles around him. I mean, his range is incredible, and the vibrato he puts on the high notes, and he can go way higher, like almost an octave higher than almost any male singer I can think of, and still has a powerful bass sound.
Right, because it's not falsetto. He's just singing. Both his sons became singers, Keith John and Kevin John. Keith John still sings backup for Stevie Wonder. And in fact, he's the only male backup singer that Stevie's ever had. And they're both wonderful singers. Kevin kind of inherited Willie's lower range and mid range. And Keith has always been able to sing those high Willie notes. Although even Keith says, he says, I can sing high, but I can't sing dad high. You know, he would have to really make an effort, and he'd do it. But it really took an effort, and Willie kept that ability. He didn't lose it as he got older, even though he only lived to 29, sadly. But, yeah, for him to retain the power and the tone at that high range is very unusual, and it's really fun to listen to.
And there's a story in your book that is pretty mind-boggling. It's a story about Willie, and he's hanging out with Jackie Wilson and another singer, I think, named Dizzy Jones, and they get into a cutting contest, and Jackie Wilson tries to warn the guy not to try to hang with Willie. Tell us what happened in that.
It's hilarious because, you know, Willie could be a bit of a gangster off stage, you know, in terms of, and this is in terms of being singers. It's like, don't ever challenge him because he's going to sing higher than you every time. Jackie knew that. And Jackie knew he would do anything to win. And so this guy, he literally had to be taken to the hospital, according to several sources, just trying to top Willie in that particular cutting contest. Cutting contests were really big in Detroit, too, and most cities at the time. The guys would get together and try to outsing each other. And it's not to take anything away from Jackie, who was just an unbelievable singer himself. But Willie had that thing in that upper range that nobody else could do, and guys would hurt themselves trying.
Yeah, the only story I've heard comparable to that is John Lennon getting Harry Nilsson to blow out his voice in a singing contest, drunken singing contest that permanently damaged Nilsson's voice. So, but the talking about Willie in Detroit, that's the context he came out of. He's a gospel-bred singer. His parents were very strict. They wouldn't let him sing the blues.
Well, I'd like to kind of delineate with the term gospel. People think of today's gospel music, or they think of a slicker presentation than what he was exposed to. It was really, you know, it was the Triumph Church, one of these holiness churches in Detroit. It was really just old-time church music that he was singing and hearing in church. And it was not like Aretha, where he was going on the road, where he was the lead singer, where he was doing a lot of this, but it was just part of the home life. They would be singing these songs at home, and it was almost more like folklore and folk songs and old blues songs you'd be singing. It was all the same to him. He did get exposed to the audience and the church, the churchgoers. The church ladies would go crazy when he'd sing as a little boy because he had such an unearthly power. And he really became addicted to the audience adulation through those experiences in the church. And the family they did go around from church to church, and they had their little group, their little singing group. And you can kind of picture it almost being like a Jackson 5 thing, where the smallest was the one with the biggest voice. But he was also the charmer and the one who was really putting the song over. So they did get booked, too. It was like almost a little business back then. The John family, they would go around, and they had a booking agent who would book them in these specific churches. So he would do that, and that was always a part of his thing. But as his own siblings said, he didn't learn how to sing in the church. He already knew how to sing. Nobody taught him how to sing. He just sang. And it was the feeling, I think, that you can't teach that anyway.
And in the book, you get this picture of a very precocious child, a child who not only is an incredibly gifted singer, but is a bright child, an A and B student at school, and also really kind of a prodigy of navigating the streets, which is ironic in light of his later fate. But this is a kid who knew all the angles.
Yeah, he was so small, but he was able to talk his way out of trouble. And there were a lot of boys in that family, and his father had a hard time keeping control of all of them, although he did try. He was pretty strict. But he would sneak out of the house, and he knew how to get around, and he knew how to fight. He was a wiry little guy, but his father would say, "I don't want you to start anything, but don't let anyone finish you." So especially he was very attentive to the way women were being treated. He didn't like to see that, so he would defend girls or his sisters anytime he saw any of that go on. So he was willing to put his fists up and fight. He would do it, but his smarts kind of helped him get out of trouble and run. And his sister, Mabel John, had provided one of his report cards from Pershing High School, and that was in his funeral program, and I had it in the book as well. As he did very well there, but he was a behavior problem at times, and they were not, they were very strict in the 50s and the late 40s in Detroit schools. So if you mouthed off or swore or were caught with a girl kissing her or something, you'd get sent to this school. It was called the Moore School. And I found out that just about every major male Motown star went to the Moore School at one time or another. And they had this great choir director there who put some of them back on the right path by channeling their energy into music. And Willie was one of those. He was not Motown, but he was definitely helped by this guy, Mr. Irvin. And Willie used to say he was his assistant choir director, maybe. But so there was that always going on with Willie. He was really smart, was too smart for his own good, but he was also misbehaving. That was part of the whole package.
And this, the level of talent that was floating around Detroit at this time, I mean, you'd already had Johnny Ray coming out of the Detroit nightclubs, Dinah Washington, but Willie, even though, you know, his hit record-making era spans from like 55 to 61, so we tend to think of him as a rock and roll era. Age-wise, he was really more of a peer. I mean, Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops and he were just homies from way back, grew up together, but he's really more of the generation of Stubbs, who's a little bit older, but then Smokey Robinson and that next wave of Motown people, Marv Johnson. But Willie was right in there with two generations of R&B performers, the people that were stars when he was, as well as the younger people that were his age who were coming up and later.
Yeah, that's a good point. He was born at 37, and Smokey was born in 40. That's just 3 years later. But Willie started so early, and he was experienced at such an early age. So he kind of bridged those generations. And he could sing, you know. He would go bother the big bands and jump up with Count Basie and sing with them. So he was able to sing any of that stuff, and he had that bravado and just the polish to his performance. So, yeah, and he and Levi were running buddies from an early age because they lived in the same project in Detroit. Their families were very close, going all the way back. Their mothers were good friends and all that. So Levi was a good source of information on Willie, and both families were, his family and his sisters were helpful too. I ran into a couple of Levi's sisters after my book came out, and they said, "You did it. You captured that time when we were growing up in the Northeast Side, 6 Mile and DeQuinder." They used to call it Cardboard Valley, the project where they grew up. And I said, "Thank goodness, thank you." Is the way I did it was to talk to as many people as I could who grew up there, whether they knew Willie or not, and most of them did. and to just to see what it was like, what were you hearing in the street, what was the music like, what was it like in the clubs. And, you know, it wasn't that far for Willie and Levi and their buddies to go down to where all the nightclubs were, what we call Paradise Valley, Hastings Street. It was torn down in urban renewal in the late 50s and early 60s. But at the time when Willie and the boys were going down there, it was happening. Everybody you'd ever want to see was singing in a club on Hastings Street. So it's that was part of his childhood. And he grew up fast. He heard all this stuff and it affected him. And, you know, that's the way it went. So, yeah, his Bridging the Generations. And, of course, he did record, too. He recorded that early Christmas song when he was discovered. And he was 14 years old, but they tried to make him look younger, and he already looked pretty young. They tried to make out that he was younger than he was because he had that high voice. But he recorded that song, and they actually took him to New York and Philadelphia, and he did a little tour that would have been like 1951. Well before 51, 52, well before the rock era or the R&B, you know, where any of that stuff was going on. It was kind of a little kitschy hit. It was supposed to be kind of a novelty song they thought they could make out. And it was Harry Balk, who became very well known in Detroit, who had discovered him. And Harry went on to discover and have the record company where all sorts of greats like Del Shannon and recorded, and he went on to work for Motown, and he had a great career. But it was Willie who first got Harry into the music business and vice versa.
And so Harry was a theater manager, and he put together a little foursome of guys, including a trash dump owner, a jeweler, and another guy that took Willie on the road. And I want to play a song from Willie, and then I want to hear a story about how he got his first New York television break. But first, let's hear his first hit, All Around the World, also known as Grits Ain't Groceries. This is Little Willie John.
Grits ain't groceries, eggs ain't poultry, and Mona Lisa was a man. All around the world, I'd rather be a fly. I light on my baby and stay with her till I die. With a toothpick in my hand, I dig a 10-foot ditch and run through the jungle fighting lions with a switch. Of course, you know I love you, baby. Yes, you know I love you, baby. Well, if I don't...
And that was Little Willie John's first rock and roll hit from 1955, All Around the World, also known as Grits Ain't Groceries. So tell us... He does this little novelty song, Mommy, What Happened to Our Christmas Tree? They take him to New York. And tell us the story about what happens in the hotel room when they see Count Basie on TV.
Well, I was talking to Dave Usher, who became a jazz producer later on, and he was one of the guys who Harry Balk talked into doing this, being a co-manager. Although, as Dave said, with much affection, Harry conned me into doing this. But... they took Willie to New York, and they were hanging out in the hotel room, and one of these early, you know, telethons came on, and Dave seemed to think it might have been a Jerry Lewis thing. It might, you know, it was local though, it was not national. And but they were in a studio, and they kept saying where they were, and Willie wanted to go down there, and they said, nope, we're going to sleep early. We got a big day tomorrow. You're not going anywhere. So he gave him the slip, and he managed to figure out how to get down there, and they're dozing off and on and talking, and next thing they know, they look on the TV, and there's Willie on the TV. He talked himself onto the set, and he's there singing. Now, Dave Usher, he's in his 80s when he was talking to me about all this stuff. He remembered it as vividly as if it happened yesterday, because it's like, stuff like this was happening all the time. And they really, it's almost as if Willie knew his time on Earth was going to be short, so he had to pull stuff like this. But they managed, somehow they managed to get him back to the hotel, and do their meetings and do what they had to do.
And some of those meetings were with a guy named Harry Glover of King Records. And tell us about Harry and that relationship.
Harry Glover was so important in Willie's career. Harry, he was very high up at King. He was the guy who produced most of Willie's stuff, especially in the early days in New York. And he heard something in Willie's voice that later on when he did sign him, and Willie did All Around the World in New York. Supposedly there, you know, just like a lot of things I found out in researching Willie's life, there would be disparate stories about how something happened, including from Willie himself. And Willie used to say that he happened upon this recording session. He happened to hear Henry Glover say that nobody could sing this song correctly, and that he, Willie, could do it, and he offered to do that. It's certainly true that somehow Henry brought the song Grits Ain't Groceries to All Around the World to Willie, and they did it in the studio. And according to Mickey Baker, who I managed to track down in France, Willie was immediately on it in the studio, and it was a perfect session. Glover, once he heard Willie singing, and this was a couple years after the New York trip, once he heard Willie sing the song, he immediately called up all the first call players, such as Mickey, brought them to the studio, and he cut All Around the World right there. I believe Willie would have been 17 for that song. Yeah. The trip with Harry and the guys was a couple years earlier.
And Glover is with King Records, and he's in a unique position because he's an African-American A&R man and producer, which is, I think, unique at the time for a label of that strength. It was one of the biggest independents in the country out of Cincinnati, run by a pretty eccentric Jewish guy named Sid Nathan. And we talked about him a lot on this show in the context of James Brown and the Delmore Brothers and other performers. It's the really unique record label that focused on country and Western with a boogie emphasis and rhythm and blues singers who were encouraged to cover country Western songs could Sid Nathan frequently own the publishing. And so there's a real synergy there. And that as long as Glover is still with King, Willie doesn't have an unbroken golden streak, but he goes on a hell of a run.
He goes on a hell of a run. And most of that stuff was done in New York. And yeah, it was with players like Mickey. Although it was interesting, Mickey Baker was older and sick when I talked to him by phone. I had a couple long conversations with him, and he was in France. And he recalled playing on Fever, but he didn't recall All Around the World. He recalled playing on the earlier version of All Around the World, but not Willie's. And I had convinced him that he was on Willie's version of All Around the World. But anyway, yeah, Glover was, you know, we give Motown a lot of credit, especially here in Detroit, for having white people of talent, black people of talent, drawing people from all around and having it all at this label. But King was wonderful in that way. And the country stuff that Willie recorded, Big Blue Diamonds, et cetera, She Thinks I Still Care, which Elvis heard, Elvis Presley, had it messengered to his house. And apparently it's still at Graceland on the wall. I have to go check that, though. But Willie had a real affinity for country music, so he fit in right away when, Sid wanted a lot of his country stuff to be recorded by his R&B guys and vice versa. Although She Thinks I Still Care was done by Dickie Lee. That was an outside song. And Dickie didn't even know that Willie had done it till he heard it. But it was, finding out what was recorded in Cincinnati and what was recorded in New York. For a long time there, Henry Glover was in charge of the New York office, so that's where Willie would be. But just as much, in fact, for the Fever session itself, from everything I could find out and research, it was done in Cincinnati, Fever was. And it was a different guitar player, not Mickey, on that. Bill Jennings.
And that's a classic example of the vagaries of memory, because Baker has vivid memories. He knows the chords of the song, and he's taking credit for unusual jazz chords. So, amazing thing about research that you get to the bottom of that stuff. Although this is one of those, Mickey Baker playing on Fever is kind of one of those print the legend stories rather than the truth, you know?
And it's kind of like Bob Dylan saying that he hitchhiked through down the whole length of Michigan, and he happened to run into a club where, as a teenager, and he saw Little Willie John singing. You know? I present it, and I say it's possible, it's true. The years could line up, but it's also possible it's myth-making by Bob Dylan, who I was pleased to, my friend Peter Wolf actually got him a copy of the book, so Dylan read it.
That's cool. And I got a little ahead of myself because I jumped to the recording career, but Willie actually went out on the road shortly after the first New York trip with a guy named Paul Williams, who's famous for a big dance song called The Hucklebuck. And Williams is one of these figures kind of like Lucky Millinder or Roy Brown that's in that pre-rock and roll stage. He's right there between swing, jump blues and rock and roll. And so Willie kind of bridges three eras in a way. He's connected to this, the jump blues era. He's a blues singer. I mean, getting on stage with Count Basie, and then, you know, right there with his peers, Jackie Wilson and James Brown, and the evolution of soul. And like we said, a big evolution, part of the evolution of Motown. But one thing I want to talk about Willie is, you know, when I first became aware of Willie was because of Leave My Kitten Alone and the Beatles connection. But then the next thing is like reading books like Peter Guralnick's biography of Sam Cooke, or James Brown's autobiography, or Ray Charles' autobiography. And Little Willie John kind of recurs as this, He's a factor. I mean, he's always talked about with great respect, but he's also sort of like not quite the bad guy, but the bad example, you know, where he's the screw up on the road. He's the guy doing too much drugs. He's the fool gambling away his money. He's the guy, you know, his little sister, Mabel John, was a backup singer for Ray Charles, but starts out on tour with Willie. And basically the mandate was from her chaperone and parents, go anywhere except where Willie is. That's how you stay out of trouble on the road.
Right. Oh, and Willie himself, that was his older sister, but he would lock her in her room. He didn't want her going out and doing what he was doing. It was okay for him, though. Oh, he was protective in that weird way.
And when you researched the book, did you find that those tales were overblown, or was Willie as wild as his reputation?
Well, you know, I wanted to have a nuanced picture of him, which is also what, his son Kevin wanted that too. To their credit, the family never asked me not to put something in. They never wanted me to avoid anything. They just wanted it done in what Kevin called a tasteful way, which I took to mean I had pretty much carte blanche.
Let's hear Little Willie John doing Fever, which probably doesn't have Mickey Baker on it, but might have the ghost of Mickey Baker on it. This is Little Willie John's version of Fever.
Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight.
And that was Little Willie John doing the song Fever, which you named the book after, and which became an enormous pop hit for Peggy Lee, maybe a career-defining hit for Peggy Lee. And as we said, and I think that's a really good illustration of the way Willie bridges the jazz and the rock and roll influence. That to me is more of a jazz pop song than a heavy jazz song. It's not a white song or a soft song, but it's very jazzy and sophisticated.
It is. Yeah. And talking about Willie being on the road and being wild, I have to say, Clarence Avant said that it almost killed him being the road manager for Willie early in his career. That was his first non-club job for Clarence, who, of course, went on to have Sussex Records and Bill Withers and all that. And same thing with Harry Balk, his first manager. Harry said he finally had to give up managing Willie because the calls at 2 a.m., 3 a.m., he would freeze in bed, like, what on earth has happened now? You know, Willie's in some distant city, in trouble, asking for money, whatever. But at the same time, I think some of the drug taking was a little exaggerated because Willie had a problem with epilepsy. And oftentimes if you're taking phenobarbital or if you're not, it can be mistaken, a spell for being drunk. So sometimes when he was drunk, he really was drunk. Sometimes he was having a spell. He was having a seizure. But
And Willie around this time is a road warrior, and he's a wild man, but he's delivering the goods, and he inherits Little Richard's band, the Upsetters, a legendary crew out of New Orleans. And for a while there, I mean, could anybody touch him on the R&B circuit?
Oh, no. And even Little Richard says that they were almost born to play behind Willie. And I was so lucky to be able to talk to at least some of the guys. And then I had access to a manuscript that the drummer had written about just what it was like to back Willie up on stage and how powerful his vocals were. You know, they'd come out in the style of the 50s and they would play first. And then after a couple songs, he'd come out. He'd start singing before he even came out onto the stage. And his voice was so powerful, they could see the curtains ruffling right before he came out. So, yeah, they'd be walking the bar, you know, the saxophone players, and doing all their crazy stuff. And he'd keep up with that, although he didn't. I got two different views of Willie on stage. One said he could dance just like anybody. And the other view was he didn't have to dance. He'd just flat foot sing. So probably a little of both going on.
And tragically, there's no video evidence of Willie performing. The only video we have is a cameo of him playing the bongos on Route 66. But despite having done multiple TV appearances in his life, none of those were kept for posterity.
Yeah, he's playing clays there. But I know that it's got to be out there because he was on American Bandstand at least three or four times. That's documented. And the whole thing about, that stuff's burned up in a warehouse fire. No, it didn't. Stuff keeps trickling out. And he was on the early Tonight Show. His sons told me. I tried to look into that when I couldn't find anything. He was on a bunch of New York shows. He was on other regional programs. And I know back then a lot of musicians had those early cameras, and they were experimenting with them. Back then it was 16 millimeter, you know, and I know Levi Stubbs said he had one, didn't have any footage of Willie, unfortunately, but they would go out and they would film at the Apollo. And though somebody had to have been at the Apollo with a film, with camera, and got something. So I'm still confident something will turn up. I just think it's probably somewhere in a box and nobody knows what it is.
So if you're listening, and if you got a box that your granny handed down to you that says Little Willie John on TV, please dig that up and let us know.
Right.
And Willie like comes out of the gate with a number 5 R&B hit with All Around the World and a number 1 R&B hit with Fever. Fever gets on the pop charts in the lower 20s, but then he has kind of a cold streak in 1957 and isn't on the charts at all. But he recovers from that with Talk to Me, which might be his most beloved song. What do you make of that cold streak? Was that a function of King Records not knowing what to do with him? Because James Brown had a very long cold streak after his first hit as well with King. What do you attribute to that?
I don't think it was any one thing in particular. He was touring a lot at that point. He was very successful. I think maybe they were not getting him the best material. It wasn't working out as well. That's around the period when he really wanted a more highbrow presentation, a more upscale presentation. He wanted strings on his songs, and they weren't Sid Nathan had a pretty very standard view of what R&B was. You know, it was saxophone, guitar, bass, drums, but not strings. And he had to kind of fight his way into allowing them to see him as a ballad singer as well, not just a, quote, rock and roller. And so I think that might have been going on a little bit. And, of course, he proved them all wrong with Talk to Me. It's a beautiful ballad. And it went on from there. But, yeah, maybe he was too busy buying Cadillacs and being Willie and having fun. Although they had him in the studio quite a bit.
Yeah, they were turning out marking the tape. But the Cadillac thing, that's another thing where King tended to pay Willie in Cadillacs. And Willie was very young and may or may not have understood that every time he took a Cadillac or he asked for an advance on the road, that was not only being docked against his record royalties, but was extending the life of his contract.
Right. He always thought in terms of how many singles and albums he was delivering to them instead of thinking in terms of time or vice versa. It was just not, he wasn't really well advised. He didn't have a good lawyer telling him about these things, and it was delaying the inevitable, and he couldn't get out from under the yoke of that contract when he wanted to. When Sid started to get sick and Willie's career had really hit the skids, it would have benefited him if he could have gotten onto Capitol and had Capitol release that later recording. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but he was being courted a bit by them, and that would have been a fresh start. But there's no way Sid was not going to let that happen while he was living. He just wouldn't let him off. And technically, Willie was tied. He had nothing to do. He still owed them sides.
And James Brown almost ended up having to take over King Records and that was after Sid Nathan died, to win those contract battles. I mean, Sid Nathan was a force, and Willie was not the most together businessman by any stretch of the imagination. But one person he did let go was Henry Glover. And so once Glover leaves King, Willie's kind of adrift. And let's hear one more song. Let's hear Leave My Kitten Alone, which was an R&B hit and famously covered by the Beatles. This is Little Willie John doing Leave My Kitten Alone. And that was Leave My Kitten Alone, the big near miss for Little Willie John. It was an R&B hit, but at a point after the Beatles came along and he couldn't buy a hit, hadn't had a hit since 1961, he got word that the Beatles had recorded a version of Leave My Kitten Alone. And I mean, talk about a lifeline being thrown to you, manna from heaven, but it didn't come out. Do we know why that record wasn't released?
I think from everything I can read about the Beatles sessions and all that, they just thought there were too many Lennon vocals on that album. It was something like that. Although I think there were too many Lennon vocals, and maybe that was it. They had to put something else on there to even it out. It's something that I really wish I'd gotten to be able to ask Paul McCartney if he remembered. I still hope so. Maybe for a paperback edition for an advance for a next edition of the book.
Yeah, and if you don't get Sir Paul, maybe Mark Lewisohn, the maniacal Beatles biographer, might know.
Yes.
He seems to know everything, every move they ever made. But like
because
you said,
the other big question is was Lennon primarily familiar with the Johnny Preston version of "Leave My Kitten Alone," which of course was a cover version of Willie's. Or was he also well aware of the Willie version? I tend to think he was aware of both. So, yeah, that's my hope anyway.
Yeah, listen to the Preston version. The kind of songs that drew John Lennon, things like To Know Him Is to Love Him, or the early Carole King, Goffin King songs, and I'm blanking on the name. But those were these big, meaty songs sung by powerful singers. And you listen to the Johnny Preston version, and you're not hearing that. And if you hear the Little Willie John version, you can hear what would have drawn Lyndon's ear. Although when you listen to John's version, my God, the vibrato he's putting on those high notes. I mean, Lennon does a great version, maybe even cuts Willie on it. It's hard to say, but he does not sing those notes at all.
He does not.
No. I mean, he's hitting the notes, but he's not doing the vibrato and the high end. He's belting it out. And Willie is singing it.
And I have to wonder, you know, it's kind of Leave My Kitten Alone by the Beatles is sort of unfinished. They didn't do the full production. I have to wonder if they were going to put on the meow chorus later on, which was only on the Willie version, I believe.
Yeah, my little girl, she knows the Beatles very well, and I was playing Little Willie John in the car today, and she was really attracted to the meow version and then wondered why. She thought he was doing a Beatles song, and she was like, how does he add something to a Beatles song like that? but it's very noticeable, but it's two great versions of the song. I mean, I think that the Beatles song is more of a rock song, and Willie's is much more danceable and fun with the chorus. But around this time, I mean, it's not just that the hits have dried up. It's that Willie's become so unreliable. He's almost the George Jones of R&B. I mean, he's not showing up for gigs. It's making it into the trade papers. There's a string of arrests for things like bad checks, telephone fraud, some assaults, some marijuana possession, and he loses the Upsetters. And so how bad of a skid was Willie on in this period?
It was a bad skid, and you know, it wasn't just one factor. It was losing the band, having no big hits, and his health was deteriorating because, you know, if you take anti-seizure medication and drink, it's going to make everything worse, and, you know, everything, he was at a lull, and if he had been able to kind of seg into a different record company, a refreshment of his career, that would have really helped. But that wasn't the case. And he was playing worse and worse gigs, worse, because by the time in Seattle the incident happened where that led to his imprisonment, that he was playing a place called the Magic Inn, which a guy from there who was at the gig told me, imagine the worst club in Detroit. Just imagine. That was the Magic Inn, apparently. So it was quite a come down for someone who had been one of the biggest R&B stars of 55, 56, 57.
And one thing that you do in the book that nothing else you're going to read about Little Willie John will tell you about is he had carved out a family life for himself. I mean, you don't see that in the other stories about Willie John. You just see the wild man backstage. But when he wasn't on tour, or when he was touring with his wife and two young sons, things were pretty copacetic. They had a dream house in Miami, and they had a little bit of domestic bliss. I was happy to hear that there was a period in his life when he was calm and happy.
Oh yeah, and I love one of the wonderful parts of doing all this project is the time I got to spend with the John family and getting to know Darlin' John, his wife, his widow, who was never told her story before because it was so painful at the end for her, and to see what kind of person she was that he married, that with for all his wild behavior with women especially, and he ended up marrying a woman who was a dancer, but she was a quiet girl, as the other musicians called her, a quiet girl. He was, you know, a nice girl who would stay at home and do things and keep the home and keep the children, raise them well. And she really did a good job with those kids, with the boys, men, you know, Kevin's almost my age. And it's amazing that she did that because the financial structure was just taken away, what money she had when Willie died. But she was so helpful to me in describing Willie, describing his personality. And she saw him on the road, of course, because they met backstage at the Apollo playing cards. And she kind of saw it all. But she told me one of the funnest things that she said, if you want to get the feeling of being in the same room with Willie, sit between Kevin and Keith, his sons, because they're both chatterboxes. They're both very lively and energetic. And it's this kind of male John energy that you sense when you hear stories about Willie, and you see it in real life when you encounter his sons. And they both look like him, Kevin especially. So I got to be at Levi Stubbs' house after he'd had his strokes, but he could still talk somewhat, and he was telling stories about Willie. But we all laughed until we were crying, because Keith, they're both cut-ups, Kevin and Keith, just like their father. Willie was always the life of the party. But Keith would do an impression of his father singing. He'd get down on his knees to kind of epitomize how short Willie was. And he was singing like his father. He was singing like Willie, and Levi was just about dying laughing. So this was fun.
You know, there's some stories you tell in the book. I'm sorry to cut you off. But that sort of a premonition of what ultimately happened. And there's stories that don't paint Willie in a bad light. His habit of protecting women. There was one incident when there was an African-American girl that was being lured into the woods by some white guys with bad intentions. And Willie got off the bus to rescue them.
Yeah. Yeah, he wouldn't think about how small or what size he was. He just ran after them, and nobody else on the bus did. They were all going, "You're nuts." But he managed to get the girl back on the bus, and they took her to safety. Whatever was going on out there was not going to happen, and he helped her out. And now, Darlin told me stories to that effect as well. Like, I don't think it was in the book, but she told me one time that whenever he was home from the road, he would take over all the stuff, and she'd go to take the trash cans out, for example, and he'd say, "No, you're not." Or she wouldn't go down to the corner store at night, and he'd go, "You are not going down there at night. It's not safe." And she'd say, "Willie, what do you think I do when you're not in town? I have to do that stuff all the time." But she was to be protected when he was there. He would not allow it. And he was that way with his children, too. She said he would physically bristle if somebody he didn't know tried to pick them up as toddlers and babies. He did not want people touching his children. So, yeah, he was that way with his sisters, too. And he had several sisters. So yeah, that was a good thing about him. And Darlin was very, she spoke of him that way with great affection, that he always took care of her in that way. And interestingly enough, too, to jump back to Sid, Darlin also told me that despite all the stuff that went on with Sid, including he had told him he wouldn't let him off King Records, he still felt fondness for him, and it was reciprocated. They were in contact when Willie was in prison. They wrote letters back and forth, and he thought of him in a paternal way. And there was a ring, there was a ring that Sid had given Willie, and Darlin told me about that. It got lost over the years, but he cherished that ring.
And yeah, so there's a family atmosphere. It might have been dysfunctional family, but there was real connection and real caring. Sid had that same relationship with James Brown, where they had their fights, but ultimately there was a great deal of love and an effective partnership. And let's hear one last Willie song. This is from the Capitol Sessions from 1966. It wasn't released for decades, but this is "I Had a Dream." And that was Little Willie John doing "I Had a Dream" from the Capitol Sessions. And tell us a little bit about this. I mean, we'll get to the tragedy in a minute, but he's literally under indictment for manslaughter. And he gets this deal from Capitol Records with a $10,000 advance and gets to record with Earl Palmer and Carole Kaye and the cream of the L.A., the wrecking crew, the cream of the L.A. session mafia. How did this happen that he almost gets this deal with Capitol Records?
Well, his sister Mabel, who of course had been the lead Raylette with Ray Charles, she was living in Los Angeles at the time and had contacts, and she says that she got him that deal for the $10,000 advance with Capitol because Willie had told everybody that his contracts were up. He thought because a certain time had passed that was the case, and it really wasn't. But so that, you know, he was able at that point, he was no longer jumping bail. They allowed him to go home to Detroit and to do various gigs. So he went down, and it was his dream to record at Capitol because he loved Sinatra. He loved that whole milieu. And Studio A at Capitol Records, are you kidding? It was his dream. He even dressed like those guys, like the Rat Pack. And David Axelrod, he was given the job since he had Lou Rawls under his purview. He was the guy who did that, who produced it. And yeah, I talked to David about it, and it was just it was a wonderful session. And Darlin remembers hanging out with Lou Rawls' mom, and they had a great time recording. Although David said sent things to make me believe that he thought more of Lou Rawls than Willie. I'm not sure if that was a behavior thing or what, but they went really well. It was just that it had to be totally shelved. Once Sid Nathan got wind of what was going on and King, they said, no, you're not doing it. And it was the biggest heartbreak, I think, for the family and for Willie, but the family for sure, because someone anonymously sent them an acetate of the session after it was shelved. And I think it was just after Willie died that they were sent this acetate in the mail. And Kevin John said he would play it just over and over and over right after his father died and until he wore it out, basically. So it became a thing with him that this was his father's dream to record this jazz album at Capitol Studios, and he wanted to get it out. And at various times, that he would be in contact with Capitol over the years, and it would be like, well, nope, this guy dies in prison. We're not going to put this record out, you know. That then there, you know, they would claim they lost it, and then, oh no, we didn't lose it. Here it is, and yeah, it was a checkered history with that recording.
And eventually, though, it does come out. Ace Records out of England puts it out. And the John Brothers had four goals when they said they wanted to get their father in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or see him in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They wanted to get the unreleased record out. They wanted to get a book written about him. And they wanted to see a major motion picture about him. And so far, they've done three out of the four.
Right. It's we've had a couple people option the book to make a movie, and it just, like a lot of things like that, didn't work out. But I'm still hopeful because, you know, how many more movies can you have about, we all know James Brown's story pretty much. This is a story people don't know. And it impinges on so many other acts. It's got the Beatles, it's got Elvis Presley, it's got Peggy Lee in the whole 50s scene. It's got the big band. The whole the way Detroit was in the 1950s is fascinating when you talk to guys like Levi Stubbs and all the guys pre-Motown. Because people think of Detroit in terms of Motown, but the 1950s were almost more interesting. What led to Motown and how all that happened. Which, by the way, Mabel John told me several times that she, her brother, Willie, and Berry Gordy admired each other, but Willie needed a going concern. In 1955, there was no Motown. It wasn't even thought of by Berry Gordy. He was shuffling around in town. And by the time he would have been able to record Willie John, he was tightly wound into King. It's one of those woulda, coulda, shoulda. Maybe something could have happened again after King wound down if he could have gotten him out of the King contract in the 60s. Because around 63, 64, when King was winding down with Willie and vice versa, that was when Motown was exploding, of course.
Yeah, and let's go ahead.
I think there was a, Mabel did tell me that she tried to bring Gordy songs a couple times to Willie, but none of that worked out.
Yeah, that was when Gordy was writing hit songs for Jackie Wilson and producing them. And then Gordy went on to produce some hits for Marv Johnson, who figures in a story about Gunplay that I want to get in before we talk about the final tragedy. So Willie and Marv Johnson, and Marv Johnson, by all accounts, and maybe I'm sure his family has another side to it, but if you read the Motown Tales, Berry Gordy paints a very negative picture of Marv Johnson as this pretty egomaniacal guy. And Willie and Marv get into it backstage, and Willie calls him out into the alley. And what happens when they go back into the alley to fight?
Well, Willie pulls out a gun. I mean, he always had to equalize the thing. Marv was a big guy. Marv was a sweet guy, too. I don't think it's hard for me to picture Marv as a fighter because I knew him. I met him in the course of reporting on Motown, and he just didn't seem that kind of guy, although most R&B stars and musicians of the time packed guns because they had to on the road. They had to get their money. They had to protect themselves from other bad guys, and the promoters all had guns. So it wasn't that unusual a thing, but Willie would... he would pull a gun just to be an idiot. But, yeah, as Marv recounted, he had the wrong bullets and the wrong gun. And the bullets just fell out of the gun. As you know, Willie was no big-time gangster. He was just trying to get people to leave him alone or be impressed. And it had the effect, kind of, once they got done laughing.
And in the book, you do a pretty good job of detective work on what happened in Seattle on that fateful day. And it's pretty dark stuff. I mean, this is seedy stuff. He's playing the worst club in Seattle, which is being compared, like you said, to the worst clubs in Detroit. And he ends up partying on into the next day and is in a sort of speakeasy in a dude's house on a Sunday afternoon in Seattle. And what happened then?
Yeah, we call those blind pigs in Detroit, and it's pretty common in music business. The musicians always know where to go afterwards, where you can drink illegally. And apparently, I lucked out because I found the writer of a... there wasn't a lot of stuff written about Willie over the years, but there was a Village Voice story done by Kim Field. And you can't even find that original Village Voice story without digging a lot, because that particular issue got the warehouse burned down. Warehouses always burn down. But I managed to find a fan of Willie's in Detroit who got the copy to me. And then I tracked Kim down, the author of that story. He's a musician himself, and he's living in Seattle. And he got me in touch with the prosecuting attorney who had prosecuted Willie, which was amazing that this guy was not only still alive, but that he said it was the most unusual and memorable case he'd ever been involved in. So thanks to Kim, I was able to talk to him and a couple others. And the family even thought at one point they might try to get an Innocence Project kind of thing involved in this. But it's... you know, Art Swanson was the guy. He was the retired prosecutor. He was a young prosecutor at the time. And what he told me was, even though he was prosecuting Willie, he saw so many opportunities that the defense attorney should have been taking to defend Willie. But the defense attorney was this guy named Bill Lanning, who actually had a music background. He's the one who got Stan Getz off. When Stan Getz was in town and he was having trouble with drugs and he knocked over a pharmacy or something. But by the time Willie's thing happened in 64, this was like, he was a drunk himself, Lanning, according to Swanson, and he was not at the top of his game. So the only defense that Lanning put up, and what had happened was, this guy in the after hours club, which was in a house, there were all sorts of people there. There were judges, there were white people, black people, people from all forms of society. It wasn't just a sleazy thing. It was more of a nightlife thing. They were there drinking, and Willie had been drinking a long time, and he'd been followed. His party had been followed by this tall guy who was sort of had an anger issue and kept arguing with people. He was a railroad worker, they've discovered later. And this railroad worker had an argument with a black attorney at the party about Martin Luther King Jr. and nonviolence. And then he started insulting some of the women, and Willie took exception to that. And then things get confused at this point, because at some point a knife appears. At some point the guy, the railroad worker, falls over, and people think he's drunk and leave him alone. Or even if they think he's hurt, they're afraid to call the police or the ambulance service. They try to first find a doctor or an ambulance service that is in cahoots that won't report this to the police. And they can't find anyone who will come, and things get worse and worse. And even Willie claims that he called an ambulance service. But by the time an actual ambulance came, it was too late for this guy. So the question, who had knifed him? There was just so many different stories that people heard from the witnesses there. Witnesses recanted. There were a lot of people who just ran out of the house before any help came, and because they didn't want to be caught there. Art Swanson told me that one witness actually had herself committed to an insane asylum so she wouldn't have to testify. It was just unbelievable. But some of the things that Lanning could have presented as a defense, the size alone. Willie was 5'4" and 5'5" at best. And this guy was 6'3" who had attacked him and in the course of the fight. That would have been a defense. Another defense would have been, there were other people arguing with this guy at the party. There was confusion. Nobody was quite sure and had different stories. Somebody knifed him, but who did it? The confusion over that could have been a factor too. But the only defense that Lanning put forward was that Willie had an epileptic seizure and he couldn't remember what went on.
And he also let Willie testify on stage, in court. Yeah. Right. And it took on a performance error, which, you know, most defense attorneys are like, never, never, never let your client testify. I take the Fifth Amendment protection. And then the appeal is botched. And Willie, even though he gets to go out and tour and record this whole album with Capitol Records, during the time of the legal process, ultimately he ends up in prison and he gets sent to Walla Walla, which is sort of the San Quentin of Washington State. I mean, that is a scary, grim, awful place. And he's in there with bad people. And then he passes suddenly of a heart attack, which you think is suspicious at best.
It was. Cause, I mean, his wife, Darlin, said she got letters from an inmate at Walla Walla who was telling her that he was not getting proper treatment for his seizures. And that's not surprising at all, that that would have weakened him tremendously. And he was also a bit of a smart aleck. And this inmate also said he was being beaten, which was, apart from Walla Walla, Seattle was a very conservative place, especially compared to Detroit, where he grew up. And a smart aleck black guy was not going to play well. But in the prison system, the medical attention was not good. So it's highly doubtful that it was just a simple heart attack. There was a period of time when he was just not well treated and probably beaten. So it was death by prison guard is what I think Art Swanson told me.
And a very American phenomenon continued into the 90s with the treatment of Old Dirty Bastard from the Wu-Tang Clan in prison. So a tale we keep telling, and hopefully we can stop telling at some point. But kind of a tragic end to a great life of Little Willie John. And Susan, the book is Fever, Little Willie John, A Fast Life, Mysterious Death, and the Birth of Soul by Susan Whitehall. Susan, thanks so much for coming on the show and telling us this incredible story.
Oh, thank you for having me, Nate. I love telling the story, and people should remember Willie.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate continues his Brian Jones obsession with a discussion of Alan Clayton's book, Brian Jones. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.